In the same way that exercise can change both the appearance and the strength of our muscles, meditation can change both the structure and the effectiveness of our brains.
Welcome to Thriveology Lab Podcast, where we explore the science, philosophy, and practice of thriving. Our goal is to help you create a happier and healthier life through education, application, and transformation. Your co-hosts on this journey are Phil Dunwoody, that's me.
And Neil Lutterbach, that's me. Phil and I are both on the faculty at Juniata College, where we teach courses to promote human thriving and well-being. Phil, before we get started, can you tell the folks where they can find us?
Everywhere. You can find us on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, YouTube. You can leave a comment or question on YouTube and we'll be sure to respond. You can also follow us on Instagram, Facebook, and LinkedIn, and send a question or comment to thriveologylab@gmail.com.
So today's topic, we're so excited. We have an interview with Holly Rogers. Holly is one of the developers of the Intro to Mindfulness curriculum and a co-founder of the Mindfulness Institute for Emerging Adults, formerly known as the Center for Koru Mindfulness. She worked for over two decades as a psychiatrist at Counseling and Psychological Services, the Student Counseling Center at Duke University, where she developed strategies to help students incorporate the practice of mindfulness into their lives in a meaningful way. Holly's own mindfulness practice began more than 25 years ago when she had the good fortune to be taught and mentored by Dr. Jeff Brantley. Since that time, she has integrated the principles and practice of mindfulness into her clinical work with students and been continually inspired by the profound growth she has witnessed. Holly is the co-author of Mindfulness for the Next Generation, Helping Emerging Adults Manage Stress and Lead Healthier Lives. She is the author of The Mindful 20-Something, a handbook for young adults who wish to learn about mindfulness and meditation. She lives in Durham, North Carolina with her husband, dog, and two cats.
The opening quote, which I'll read now, "In the same way that exercise can change both the appearance and the strength of our muscles, meditation can change both the structure and the effectiveness of our brains," is from Holly Rogers' book, The Mindful 20-Something, which I have to say I really, really like as a meditation guide. Neil and I have used it in class a number of times. Even though the title is The Mindful 20-Something, it is quite applicable. I recommend it to people in their 40s and 50s. The issues it addresses in terms of knowing yourself and a mindfulness practice really are not just about 20-something.
So, even as a 50-something, every time we read it, I come like, oh, yep, yep.
Yes,
I learned something new.
The book, so that'll be one of our recommendations. You should read the book, right? Because it explains a lot of kind of common roadblocks, might not be the right word, but stumbling things that people experience when they start a mindfulness practice and they think, oh, I'm doing it wrong or I'm no good at this. And everything you're thinking in terms of that chatter to some extent is, I think, represented pretty well in the book. So I'll plug the book to start with. Your center, Holly, is called the Mindfulness Institute for Emerging Adults, right? And I thought maybe you could start off by telling us a little bit about what the center is and what it does and this idea of emerging adulthood.
Great. Well, I'm so happy to be here with Phil and Neil today. I know y'all because you have worked with our center and have been through our teacher training program. So I know y'all know about our program from the inside. So the Mindfulness Institute for Emerging Adults, we're an organization. Our mission is to train folks, educators, counselors, administrators, whoever, who work with emerging adults. And I'll talk in a second about what emerging adults are, and help them learn the practice of mindfulness. And our vision is that these young adults everywhere are going to live lives in which they thrive and feel meaning and purpose and develop kindness and empathy.
That's a nice mission. So what's like the scope of some of the things the center does?
Well, so emerging adults, I'll get to that and then I'll talk about the scope. So emerging adults are folks who are between the ages of 18 to about 30. So it's a developmental stage. It's a super interesting developmental stage. It is in many ways one of the most challenging stages of our life because there is more uncertainty, there is more change. It's when we make our biggest life decisions, right? So folks move more often in their 20s. They have more romantic partners. They have more jobs. Like in their 20s, people have on average 8 to 9 different jobs. Wow. And so there's just constant change. So the result of that constant change is that the large majority of emerging adults say their life is exciting, and also the large majority of emerging adults say their life is really stressful and that they feel anxious. Most of them say they feel anxious often. So,
which we've seen this kind of national rise in anxiety and depression.
Absolutely.
In adolescence into emerging adults. I mean, that's, you work at a university, says to Neil and I, and that's been something our universities and colleges have really struggled with, is rising depression and anxiety, and, exactly, and how to, you know, we're treating that on the backside. Mm-hmm. And some of us, you know, feel that if we did things like promote a more mindfulness practices, we'd be helping with prevention.
Exactly. So we call our organization MIA, by the way. That's the shortcut, MIEA, Mindfulness Institute for Emerging Adults is MIA. At MIA, we are really interested in, well, what would happen if we took a public health approach to this rising tide of anxiety and stress? And we really got in front of it and really tried to teach these young people these strategy, these skills to live with less anxiety and more intentionality and more purpose, more ease, right? Mm-hmm. To just really change the way they were showing up for their lives so that they dealt with the uncertainty with more confidence, right? Less overwhelm. So our mission has kind of gotten much bigger than I ever thought it would. I started teaching mindfulness to the students who were coming into the counseling center at Duke, because I myself had been a practitioner for many years, practitioner of mindfulness and meditation, and boy, had it changed my life. And I thought over and over, I wish someone had taught me this when I was in medical school. Why did nobody teach me this when I was a medical student? This would have made my experience so much easier and so much more profound for me. So when I started working with students and they were coming in and I saw how stressed they were and how that stress was preventing them from really engaging with their education. You know, so I actually am in private practice now, but I worked at Duke University for years and years and years. And so these students at Duke, like, they had worked their butt off to get to Duke University. Like when they found out they were going to Duke, it was like, oh my goodness, this is amazing. So they're so excited. They've sacrificed so much to get there. They get there. And what do? They immediately start freaking out about how are they going to get out of there, right? It's like every semester, oh my God, I just have to get to the end of the semester. And I was just watching them and I was like, hey, y'all, look around. Mm-hmm. You worked so hard to get here. This place is physically beautiful.
Yeah.
It is filled with professors and mentors and staff people who are so interesting. The arts are amazing. Your peers are such interesting, fun people. Like, engage, look around, stay present, be here, learn. And it's totally going to change the way you feel. And you're going to, when you leave here in 4 years, you're going to be so well educated, right? So I was, you know, like, and I really wanted that for these students. And I really believed that if I could help them start to learn mindfulness, which is, you know, mindfulness is this practice of being present with kindness and curiosity. Like, what's happening today? What is important to me in this moment? And if I could just help them put their mind there instead of, oh my gosh, what if I don't, you know, I've got to do all these things. And what if I fail this test? And what if nobody, you know, likes my post, or what if I get ghosted, or, you know, just all this worry, and they were totally missing the beauty of their life. So I just tried to teach these students at Duke University about mindfulness, and I discovered I was terrible at it. I couldn't figure out how to interest them. I could get a few to start, and then after like a couple of weeks, they were like, yeah, I got to go worry about this other stuff. I can't do this. So I just kind of got I was just off in my own like weird little corner, just kind of getting obsessed about, well, there's got to be a way to teach students mindfulness that, I know it'll benefit them. I mean, and I really was in a weird little corner. So our the counseling center at that time was over on top of the it was a set of offices on top of the auditorium, which was the main performing arts space, right next to the chapel. And so we had a few offices kind of on top of the auditorium. And if I wanted to find a space to teach mindfulness, they kind of humored me, like, well, what is that? But whatever. Okay, you could do that. And but the only room was this dark little weird space in the basement underneath the auditorium. So I was like down there in the room, trying to convince students to go sit down there and learn mindfulness with me. And then the chapel bells, because we were right next to the chapel bells just boom out, and I'd be trying to teach mindfulness, and they're just like gong, gong. And then they start playing every day at 5 o'clock, the chapel at Duke. I know I'm going far astray here, guys,
No, it's
that's
awesome.
fine.
the chapel bells at Duke, not only do they gong the time, but they play like a beautiful like song. Like, I don't know exactly how it works, to be honest, but we have like this really skillful like professional bell player, and so there's like this song that goes on, it's really loud, and I'm like down in the basement trying to teach people mindfulness. Anyway, it was hard. It was
Yeah,
very hard.
that's a challenging environment.
Yeah. But after years of trying different things and trying different things, and then I had another colleague who came and helped me, and we eventually came up with a curriculum. See, I'm eventually getting to your answer, guys. We eventually came up with a curriculum that students really responded to. They would stick with it. They would do the practices. We made it short. We were trying to find the lowest effective dose of mindfulness. We were trying to teach them a bunch of different skills. We were trying to keep it moving to hold their attention. And at the end of the 4 weeks, it was a 4 week curriculum, they were like going, wow, this really changed my life. I would have flunked out if I hadn't done this, or I feel totally different about being at Duke, or wow, I realized I don't actually want to go to law school. I want to do something else. So, I was like, great, look, I can help all these Duke students. And then it just kind of started to grow from there. I was like, well, this took me a long time to figure this out. Maybe I should tell other people about this, because you can't actually teach students. It's not easy, but there's a way to do it. So, Margaret and I, the woman who, my colleague who helped me, we wrote a book about it that I didn't think anyone was going to read, but that was Mindfulness for the Next Generation. But interestingly, one of the first people who read it was the head of wellness at Harvard University. Her name was Jeannie Mahan. Amazing woman with a really long, deep mindfulness and meditation practice. And she also had been trying to teach mindfulness at Harvard and was just like not having much luck. And so when she saw our book, she was like, hey, can you come up here and like teach my staff how to do this?
Oh,
And I
interesting.
was like,
Okay. So that was the first outreach beyond Duke.
yeah. And like, it never occurred to me to do that, but I was like, sure. Okay. So I talked to a friend of mine, Libby Webb, who y'all know, Libby. And she's the co-founder of the Mindful Institute. So we went up to Boston and we taught their a group of wellness folks to teach our curriculum. And we're like, okay, well, that was fun. And then we just started getting other requests. Hey, we'd like to learn to teach mindfulness too. Can you come show us how to do it? So we ended up creating a workshop, and then we ended up creating a certification program, which, as I said, I know both of y'all have been through. And it has just grown. We've trained over 1,500 folks who work on over 300 campuses in 14 countries around the world.
Wow, that's
And
nuts. Yeah.
just since the pandemic, 75,000 students have gone through our mindfulness training. So, yeah, I've come a long way since my little corner in the basement, my little dark corner in the basement.
Yeah, that's quite a reach.
Hey, Holly, there's so much in what you said that I'm eager to unpack. I think not only like just your initial thought of like I wish someone had taught this to me. Like I think Phil and I's course, Ways of Well-Being, we take students down to Costa Rica and like we talk about sort of purpose and meaning and all this stuff is like stuff we never had either. And we see such a profound need for it. And I think reflectively, wow, what that would have done for me at 18, 19, 20 years old, if I'd had exposure to something like this. And so it's, you know, I love that there's these pockets of us around places seeing this need and from a grassroots ground level way, trying to implement this change, as you say, like this sort of public health, like we talk about both this as a both individual and collective issue, right? And I think also what you said about like this, I think what we often hear, and not even just in our students, but in our colleagues, is like in this sort of time traveling problem. I can't wait till Friday. I can't wait till May. I can't wait till, like, you can't wait. Like, that's so much of your life is just, you know, going away. Like the now, and it's sort of counterintuitive. And I think that's one of the benefits I find personally in mindfulness is that everything you need, you have right now. The happiness you're looking for is already here. It's not out, you know, it's not 2 days, 2 years, 20 years from now. It's right here, right now. And you talked about this sort of initial, and we talked about it in your bio, this initial encounter with Dr. Jeff Brantley, who's also a professor emeritus at Duke, a psychiatrist. What was it about that initial encounter with Dr. Brantley that got you so excited about mindfulness?
Well, we'd have to roll back just one step. I actually found out about mindfulness because I saw a book lying on a table in a bookstore. And the book was called Mindfulness in Plain English. And I don't know if y'all have read that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Hinapola Gunaratna is the author. He's a Sri Lankan monk who is just an amazing gifted teacher. But I was a late emerging adult myself. I was about 30 and I was in a major life transition. I'd been working in New Zealand. I was moving back to the United States. I wasn't sure it was the right choice. I was having a lot of anxiety and distress, sleepless nights, you know. And I just happened to be in a bookstore. And I saw this book, Mindfulness in Plain English. It was lying on a table. I picked it up just because I didn't know what that meant. Like I'd never heard of mindfulness. It looked like it was in English, but I didn't know what that was. So I picked up the book. I opened it and I started reading it. And I don't know, it just spoke to me. Like I immediately responded to what he was saying. And what he was saying, and he says it in this really direct way, was what you think will make you happy is not going to make you happy. Mm-hmm. And it is not, this is what totally blew my mind, it is not the circumstances of your life that make you happy. It's how you relate to them. And you have control over that. You can change that. And this is how. I mean, I sat down in the bookstore and I was like, I'm reading this book, right? And I left with the book. I mean, I bought it. I didn't steal it. I bought the book. I took it home. I sat down to try to meditate because, you know, he said this was going to change my life, right? And oh my gosh, it was terrible, right?
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
But I can't, it was the first time I'd ever looked inside my mind. I honestly think I was 30 years old. I don't think I had ever looked inside my mind. So I looked inside my mind and it was just this whirlwind of like, planning and worry and stress and fear and judgment, criticism, myself, other people. I mean, I sat for like 5 minutes and I got up and I was like, well, that's crap. I mean, I'm not doing that again. That was terrible.
And I think that's not uncommon.
Yeah.
Right. For a first experience.
So, you know, I have all the empathy for my students. And I'm like, mm-hmm. Yeah, no, it sucks at first for sure. But I don't know why I stuck with it, y'all. I think I must have really been suffering, right? Because I do think the only reason you would put yourself like through that and go back to it is like I needed an answer, right? I was suffering. So I was moving back to Durham, North Carolina, where Duke is. I'd done my residency at Duke. I was moving back because I was going to do a fellowship at Duke. And I had remembered that when I was a resident, there was somebody on staff. There was a faculty member who said they would teach the residents meditation or something, but none of us were interested. And I don't, poor Jeff, I don't think anyone ever paid any attention to him at first, but now, right? Anyway, so when I got back to Durham, I had this book, but I needed help, right? Like, it was really clear to me I wasn't going to, like, read this book and figure it out. I was interested in what the book said, but clearly I needed some help because it was not that easy. So I reached out to Jeff, reintroduced myself to him and said, could you please? Oh, I know what I did, actually, which kind of cracks me up now. I had absolutely no understanding or knowledge of this. I reached out to him on the phone because this was a long time ago, right? I don't know if we even had email. We should probably have email. And I asked him, Jeff, I think you do meditation. Have you ever heard of anything called mindfulness? And he kind of chuckled and said, yeah, I've heard of mindfulness. Yeah. And I was like, is that something you could teach me, show me how to do? And he said, yeah, I'd be happy to do that. So Jeff met with me weekly for a while, and then we found another couple residents who wanted to join us. And my practice started to grow. But then Jeff said to me, and you know, this is really a part of our MIA curriculum. We haven't talked about this yet, but boy, I think it's one of the key components to it. So Jeff said to me, you will not stick with this if you do not have a group, a community that you meet with every week and y'all work together and hold each other accountable. You won't stick with it if you don't. And he then introduced me to a group that I then joined, which, by the way, was terrible at first because these people would like sit there for 30 minutes without doing anything. And I thought my hair was going to catch on fire, but never did. Anyway, that lesson about how community is critical, you know, and if anyone who knows the roots of these practices that go way back, you know, 2,500 years in time and, you know, original like Buddhist teachings about some of these mind trainings where you have to have community. Yeah. That was like one of his top three suggestions is you have to have community. So when I was creating my curriculum, that was a lesson that was really important to me. Like, I need a group of students who will be together and share and talk and connect and maybe feel some, well, now we use the word belonging, right? I didn't think about it as belonging so much, but the, and now loneliness and lack of belonging is such an epidemic. And I think our curriculum, we really try to address that. Like, we really believe it has to be taught in small groups so that people can feel this connection, see the universality of their struggles, feel like they're not alone, they're learning together. And, you know, over and over, we see it about student evaluations. Like, one of the things that was most helpful was to see that other people, their minds are doing the same thing my mind is doing. They're having the same struggles I have. Even if this person looks really different or seems like they're really like, we don't really share identities, they actually are having the exact same problems I'm having. And that is so helpful.
It really, I mean, I think that's one of the things I think that the book, The Mindful 20 Something, is also helpful with, because it, even if you're doing it on your own, then, you know, you're writing about those challenges, right? That get expressed. And when we use it in the classroom, that just makes it easier for people to share it, because often they think the first thought is there's something wrong with me, right? This may be a great practice, but it's not for me. And that's, you know, that's really, I think, misunderstanding kind of what you're discovering about yourself.
Right. And I love the class that y'all teach, because I think that's great. So you have the students for a whole semester, you're creating community, you take them on this amazing trip where they all learn to surf, right? You teach them to surf.
Yeah.
I think it's so awesome. I really want to take this class. But you know, I'm sure you see that a big part of what's happening is these students are coming together and getting to know each other and having this experience together. It's totally different than if you're trying to do it by yourself.
And I think one of the things, and it's really the only class, certainly, that I teach for the fact that students in this class say, this has changed my life. This is like, and I, Phil is an awesome teacher. I can't claim that myself, but I think it has less to do with us and more to do with like this shared experience across that they have. All of them come in voluntarily to this course. They have a pretty substantial course fee attached. So it's not an easy experience because they all come with some sort of interest to improve the mm-hmm. quality of their life, and they're doing that together. So we do like mindfulness on Monday, Phil leads Tai Chi on Wednesday, and then we do a surf workout on Friday. So it's very physical, very embodied. And I think what Phil and I always try to do is try draw connections between all of these different modalities. And what I always love about your metaphor of this like workout, and you know, you wouldn't just go to the gym and try to deadlift 600 pounds. You need to work up incrementally. And I think too, that group shared experience overcomes a lot of the apprehension to even approaching the thing. Like there are people who wouldn't even go to the gym by themselves, but if you get a friend or two, suddenly I can go. If you have a friend or two to come to mindfulness, I'm more likely to do that. So I think you're absolutely spot on. Like community is the secret sauce. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, and that is something that I think Neil and I have struggled with on our campus. If we embed it in a class that students are taking, like this Ways of Well-Being class, well, then of course they're gonna do it and they're gonna get some benefit from it. But when I've held kind of open sessions, you know, basically you just sign up and we'll schedule a 4-week thing. Despite this well-documented need. In terms of anxiety and depression and how clearly mindfulness benefits those things with a regular practice, we don't get many people signing up, right? And so it's kind of, you know, one of the things I've struggled with is how to market it better. I don't know how to bring more people in to the door to start with.
So, you know, Phil, this is something that we are really at MIA spending a lot of time thinking about and talking to our various teachers about. So I will say that from when we were developing the MIA curriculum, like, I don't know, I spent years working on it, but like really like it, fine tuning it and starting to do research on it, 2010, 11, 12.
Yeah, I want to talk about that next a little bit too, because that article, the 2014 article, is an excellent kind of overview, but go ahead.
Yeah. So back then, this is actually so interesting to me. So I'm glad we're talking about it. Back then, so, you know, our curriculum, as y'all know, it's 4 weeks long. The students are supposed to come for 4 weeks and they're supposed to do they're supposed to practice for 10 minutes a day. They're building their mindfulness muscle and we're giving them different exercises and they're going to practice 10 minutes a day. Back then, even though they sort of felt pressed for time in their life, 10 minutes seemed like nothing to them. So like when we told them 10 minutes, they were relieved. It was only 10 minutes.
Oh, interesting.
Like that was easy. So 10 minutes did not seem like much time to them. There has been a dramatic change in how young people experience time. And, you know, when I read about the research about this, it seems that the likely culprit increased time pressure is the fact that we all have these smartphones and students are on them an average of 4 to 6 hours a day.
Yeah. Wow.
So if you think about that, it's like taking 4 to 6 hours of your 24, I know there's only 24 hours in your day, putting it somewhere else. So it comes out of their sleep, for one thing. Students are more sleep deprived than they used to be, but it also comes out of everything else in their life. So now, when we tell students it's only 4 weeks and you only have to practice 10 minutes a day, their reaction to 10 minutes is, that's really long.
Wow, that's amazing.
How about 3 minutes? What if I do 1 minute a day? And I'm like, well, you know, there's no data that doing mindfulness 1 minute a day is going to be helpful. Because, you know, we're like, you know, we come out of university, we're research, we're evidence-based, right? So what students used to sign up so quickly for a 4-week class, they had to practice 10 minutes a day. That seemed like no time at all to them. Every university where it was taught, they would sign up. There would be long waiting lists. That has changed so much, especially since the pandemic. Like students, they don't want to commit to 4 weeks. They don't want 10 minutes a day. That's like a really long YouTube video, y'all. Like that's really long. So we are all having to be more creative. I think a lot of the solution is doing what y'all are doing, which is embedding these practices and training in a semester-long course. So, you know, students still have to sign up for courses that they get credit for. But there needs to be some benefit they get that's an external motivator to get them to sign up. And different universities are doing it differently. Like some universities have like a wellness passport. In order to graduate, you need to get these wellness credits. And this meditation class will count as your wellness credit. Or you get Professor, you know, so-and-so, Professor Dunwoody. If you go to this 4-week mindfulness class, he's going to give you 10 extra points on your final exam, or he's going to let you drop one of your papers. So like getting professors who are invested in it to offer academic relief or credit if you go to this 4-week class. Now, we still have the problem of once they're in the class, getting them to practice a few minutes a day.
Right. And Neil and I have struggled with that with our students for sure.
Absolutely. So I'm so interested in the way time has compressed for these young people.
And that's only over a 10-15 year period you're talking about seeing that. That's a dramatic change.
It's huge. Yeah. And I was having a hard time getting my mind around it. But you know, I have a psychiatry practice as well. And it's all students. It's all Duke students. It's just right off Duke's campus. But anyway, every student that comes in, they fill out a form. And one of the questions I ask is, how many hours do you spend on your phone? And does that feel like a problem to you? Yes or no? Because I was just curious how they felt about that. And it is almost always 4 to 6 hours. And I would say, I mean, I haven't counted, but I almost never see a no, it's not a problem.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they do seem to be aware that it's
they know it's
unhealthy.
A problem.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's all tied together, right? Like if we're really trying to be open and expansive to our present moment experience, and there's all these different things pulling us out of it, it just gets harder.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So, yeah, I mean, I feel like I'm constantly trying to figure it out, and I don't think there's any easy answers to any of this.
No. And, you know, people refer to the attention economy that we're in right now, right? Because that's what all the apps are, is kind of monetizing your attention. And
exactly.
Certainly when I started teaching, I started teaching about mindfulness before I started teaching it, because I teach cognitive psychology and, you know, there's a lot of research on sustained attention tasks and kind of what mindfulness does to sustained attention, your ability to sustain your attention. So it's almost as though, right, as our attention has become shorter and shorter, the thing that would help us address it has become harder and harder to start doing. Because we're just further and further from that as a normal practice. You know, where as a kid, you know, if I was bored in the house and it was, let's say it was raining or something, I might read a book. That's a sustained attention task, where absolutely. Flipping through things on the phone is the exact opposite.
Right. And I think we don't know the consequences of this. Like, I vividly remember exactly what you're talking about, being a bored kid at home. It was raining. I have anything to do. I remember sitting and staring out the window and just watching the way the raindrops, their pattern on the window. And, you know, like doing that because I had nothing else to do. But, you know, I was building my capacity to attend. I didn't know that, but that's what I was doing. I was building my capacity to attend. And like, we're like not having these just opportunities, these day-to-day opportunities where we're just naturally building our capacity to pay attention. Right.
And it sounds, I'm doing some real time putting pieces together for myself as well, like with Phil's class, and like as myself, a theater professor, by and large, students won't come to do theater. They don't necessarily see the value. So what I began to do, and you know, I would understand why somebody might call this a bait and switch, but I started sort of secretly embedding the theater into courses that don't look like theater courses. So like, I have a Star Wars class called Jedi Academy. So they think they're just going to do Star Wars stuff. Really what they're doing is learning everything from acting to playwriting to stage combat to everything else, but it's embedded in this other thing that just seems like fun. And I think, you know, Phil and I's class often just in the wild often gets referred to as the surfing class, even though surfing is like such a small portion of what we're actually covering. But if they think that it's fun, if they think that it's not this work, but the work is embedded in the fun, and they don't, you know, does that make sense? Like I'm trying to find different ways to embed things so it doesn't look like another 10 minutes.
You're also making it cool though. Like surfing's kind of cool, right? Like you gotta admit, that's cool. So it has to be fun, but it has to be kind of cool also. Like, you know, I don't know.
Yeah.
And it's constantly changing, right?
Yeah.
Like what appeals, like I love the Star Wars thing and I bet students still love that. But at some point you're going to start having students like, what's Star Wars? Right,
right, right, right. Right. Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
Disney's not going to let that happen. Right.
I don't know what I'm talking about. That's like been totally taken.
No, you know, I'm reminded of, speaking of Star Wars, a fan of the Spaceballs movie. And there's a line in there where it says, yes, Spaceballs 2, The Search for More Money.
Yeah.
I think that's how, you know, Star Wars has got cachet and we're going to milk that for everything we can.
So there, Phil, now you're speaking to what I think is this other challenge we're up against. You know, I mentioned that in the Mindfulness in Plain English, one of the first things he says is what you think is going to make you happy is not what's going to make you happy.
Yeah.
Right. And when we're scrolling on our phone, every little message we're getting, buy this, get this, buy this, is that message. Money, having things is going to make you happy. Like it is so much in the air we breathe now that what's going to make you happy is acquiring things and having money.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, like y'all know, that ain't going to do it. That is that is not what happiness is about. So it is heavy lifting to get folks to rethink, well, what actually matters?
Mm-hmm.
You know, what y'all are doing, like, what is my purpose? What is meaning? What do I care about? What actually makes me feel better?
Mm-hmm.
You know,
yeah.
I actually feel better if I go like sit on the quad and talk to my friends for an hour than if I sit in my room and scroll by myself. But if you're not paying attention, if you're not really learning to monitor what is helpful to me, what is not helpful, what is useful, what if I lean into adds some sort of substance to my life that feels meaningful and purposeful, and what just kind of feels empty and maybe quick gratification. Because it's only when we really pay attention that we start to make choices that can create this life that we really want, right? Like people want to be content. They want to be engaged. This is really interesting to me. When you look at surveys of Gen Z, which is our current emerging adults, our current young adults are Gen Z. The large majority of them, it's close to 90% of them, say that they would rather do work that is meaningful than make lots of money.
Mm-hmm.
So there is this thread in the current generation where they are tapped into this idea of, I want to do something that matters.
Yeah.
And yet they don't really know how to make that happen, because everything that's thrown at them is, oh, well, what matters is having this new thing or having that new thing or having this new thing. But it's not like what their heart craves, right? Mm-hmm. It's not what their heart craves. And if we can just help them see, oh, this is the path to getting what I actually know that I want. A lot of them really want to take that path. They just don't, they don't have any experience of it. They just don't know.
No, it's so true. I mean, Neil and I talk a lot about within our class, but also together, about a lot of the challenges that we're trying to live a way that we know is good for our well-being in a society that is working against that in many ways. And that, you know, part of you mentioned the community, part of what we're trying to cultivate in that classroom environment is a deliberate focus on that extends over a period of a semester or more. And then, of course, we go on a well-being retreat. And during that time, they're eating healthy, they're spending all their time outside, they're exercising every day, and they feel happier and healthier than, you know, we've had students say things like, I didn't know I could be this happy. Right. And that's just
heartbreaking.
It's wonderful. Like, it's also a tearjerker that it's both sad and wonderful that you didn't realize it. And it is. It's to some extent all these societal messages that, you know, well, you should be doing this or you should be doing that and buying this and that it's having these things and getting somewhere else that will make you happy.
Right.
And one of the, I think what I also hear you say, Phil, and we talk about this a lot too, is like the interconnectedness of all of these things that I think for us, this idea of mindfulness goes through things like nutrition, your sleep, doing hard things, community, purpose, values, like all these things. It requires this sort of through line, the spine of mindfulness, to develop the awareness, to notice, wow, you know what? I'm not sleeping. I feel cranky in the morning. I'm eating processed foods. My body doesn't, my guts don't feel right. Like just things are out of line. And I think people are looking for the mindfulness to be this sort of one-off, like I can just do and I'm done. But what it reveals is that all of these other things may be out of alignment as well. So I think that it's become this very powerful tool for me personally, and I think for a lot of the students that we see as well.
Absolutely, Neil. I totally agree with everything you're just saying, because the mindfulness is not like, oh, I can sit and be still and watch my thoughts for 3 minutes. It's like bringing this awareness into all the things that you just mentioned, all the ways I live my life, so that I see what is useful, what's not useful, what I can lean into, what I can't lean into. And one thing I really want to go back to that you said was, I can do hard things, right? Like, that is so important. Mm-hmm. So, you know, one thing that has happened because we have our phones in our hands all the time, that anytime we feel anything uncomfortable, like any like awkwardness or loneliness or impatience or boredom, oh my gosh, nobody can deal with boredom anymore. Mm-hmm. We immediately distract ourselves.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's so easy. And because we do that, that muscle, that capacity to tolerate discomfort has shrunk, right? And if you can't tolerate little bits of discomfort, it's really likely you're going to be overwhelmed when you have to do something that's harder. Mm-hmm. But often, if we're trying to achieve these things that are meaningful and important to us, we have to be willing to sit with some struggle, right? It's okay to be uncomfortable, but folks don't really know how to be uncomfortable anymore and not feel like it's a bad thing, right? Like, discomfort is okay. And, you know, one thing I love is when young people go on, like, go into the wilderness, they go on some sort of retreat, or they go to a wilderness, they go to a camp, or probably some of the stuff y'all do. And they're out there and it's not comfortable all the time. And maybe they don't have any cell service, or maybe their leaders have said, sorry, phone can't come. And they spend, they develop so much resilience, right? Because that's what resilience is this capacity to be uncomfortable and go, okay, I'm uncomfortable. No big deal. And this capacity to be uncomfortable and just that's fine. You know, we've really lost that. And it's such an important, like, if you want to live with purpose and meaning, you have to be able to, like, lean in, right?
Well, I think this, for me, goes back to your initial sort of point about sort of our perceptions of time and this perception of, is this good, is this bad? I think we're very quick to add a valence to a thing. This is bad. I feel this feeling and it's bad. Whereas, like, as a creative person, I require boredom. Like, I have, like, I can't be like to your raindrop watching. Like, that's sort of to see the patterns and see the art of that, those raindrops, requires an element of boredom. Like, you probably wouldn't see that if you had 1,000 things going on. It would just be another bit of noise. And I think that switching over that shift of perception, that this is actually not this, yes, I'm uncomfortable, but it's actually a good thing. Yeah. That doing this hard thing, I'm not necessarily going to like it as I'm doing it, but it's essential to some, going through it is essential, because what's on the other side is so critically important.
Right. And it's really about nervous system regulation, right? Like, if you want to get down to the neurobiology of it, like, our capacity to regulate our nervous system requires that we have the capacity to sit with discomfort, right? And that's how we calm and settle our nervous system. And boredom, like, the two things that I hear the students I work with, like, they really hate is awkwardness and boredom, which you know, those are kind of mild discomforts, right? Like awkward and bored. They're kind of mild, but they will do anything to avoid awkwardness and boredom. Like, oh, that's awkward. Like, that's right.
No, but you do. You need the tolerance. You need to build up some tolerance for those things, to your point, so that you have resilience, so that, you know, you have to in life have difficult conversations. You have to face things that that you don't like, that are deeply uncomfortable, either about yourself or about the world you live in. And you can't just run away from those things. It doesn't work.
Yeah.
Right. And so, yeah, building that ability, and we very much talk about it as kind of learning to regulate your body's energy. You know, we use this language a lot in Qigong and Tai Chi about kind of awareness of your body's energy and kind of the breath work that goes with that. And there's, of course, tons of overlap with mindfulness as a practice between, you know, Tai Chi and Qigong and mindfulness. This is part of what Neil and I bring in, you know, to the class. Gosh, there's so many things, so many places we could go from here. This has been a wonderful conversation. The
talk for days.
I guess that's a question for you, right? So there's a paper that you published with some co-authors in 2014, which was really a lovely, it's titled A Randomized Control Trial of Kuru, a Mindfulness Program for College Students and Other Emerging Adults. And I'm just going to summarize very briefly, right? Randomized control trials are kind of the gold standard in terms of scientific reasoning. It's what we really like to see. You had about 90 participants, I think, randomly assigned to a waitlist control. And participants completed measures of stress, sleep problems, mindfulness, self-compassion. Then they went through the 4-week Kuru mindfulness program, completed these things again. And at the end, this research showed decreases in perceived stress, decreases in sleep problems, increases in mindfulness and self-compassion. And these differences occurred in the mindfulness group, but not the waitlist control. And then those results replicated when the waitlist control then went through the Kuru program. I mean, it's an impressive study. It's really well done. And so I have a couple questions. So that was 2014. Has anything changed about the model that you're using in terms of the 4-week program since then? And have there been any other kind of follow-up research articles evaluating the program?
Yeah, so there have been a number of other research articles. Other folks who are teaching our model have been doing research on it. So there are a couple folks down at Georgia Tech who have a big data set. And there's been some nice research. We originally did not teach online. We only taught in person, you know, my obsession about community and groups. But the pandemic forced our hand.
Yeah.
And we had to start teaching it online, but we didn't have any data about, well, does this work online? And a couple different universities where they were teaching our program, they immediately started collecting data and found that it was as effective online as it was in person. And then the folks at Georgia Tech, they did some longer follow-up studies. So they looked at students 8 weeks, and then another study just came out earlier this year where they had 1 year follow-up to see how much of the benefits maintained. And I can't remember all the details. And they have a massive data set. There's a statistician who's one of the researchers. They're measuring lots of variables, like 50 different variables. So it was all quite complicated. But the bottom line was that many of the students carried this through line of mindfulness that continued to benefit their wellness a year later, even if most of them, you know, were not still doing much practice.
Interesting. I have to look that up. I very much want to read about that 1 year out.
And this same group, because they have this huge data set, they just this week published, sent me a publication that had just been not just accepted, I think it came out. And then what they were looking at is like, okay, what is the cascade effect? And if you learn mindfulness, does it naturally cascade to self-compassion? And then does it naturally cascade to pro-social behavior?
Oh, fascinating.
Yeah, it was really interesting. And what they found was, because they were really looking at prejudice and they were measuring it in lots of different ways. And what they found was that mindfulness, self-compassion, they flowed, but it was much harder to show that it changed deeply held belief systems, which actually makes sense. Like, right, 4 weeks of mindfulness is probably not going to change a deeply held belief system. And yet, that doesn't mean that it doesn't change the way people choose to behave, like the choice they make in the moment. Like, they may see the belief system and then make a different choice.
Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah,
So,
acknowledging your own biases sometimes doesn't mean the biases go away, but it may change how
absolutely.
we respond to them.
That is something that I have learned so much over the last few years as I've really worked on my own identity and what it means to be a white woman with economic privilege, and discovering that I had biases that I had been blind to. And even, with years of practice and work, it's not that those biases all naturally go away, although some of them do, I'm aware. I can tell that some of them have, but mostly it's I have the choice to decide how I'm going to be in each moment as I'm aware of what my unconscious tugs are, right?
Yeah, and to tie back with what we were talking about earlier, you can't even acknowledge those biases you might have, I feel like, unless you can sit with some discomfort, right? Because it is
Absolutely.
uncomfortable to
Oh,
recognize some of those things.
nobody wants to do that.
And we often reference Viktor Frankl on here. And one of the things Frankl always talks about in his writings is like there's a stimulus and a response. And what you want to do is create as much of a gap between those so that it is truly a response and not a reaction. And some of those biases just cause us to react. And then, but once we can put some gap, it may not get rid of the bias altogether, but I can choose a different response to this.
Absolutely. And that's what I love, that like the awareness gives us choice. And that is making me think of, golly, there's a quote, and I'm trying to remember who says this, but I think it is Larry Yang. I think it is Larry Yang, who's a great meditation teacher out in California. And I think he's the one that says our awareness gives us in every moment the choice between moving towards suffering or away from suffering. It's like, wow.
Yeah, that's profound.
That's
It is
profound.
pretty profound because there's so many ways, subtle ways that we can choose, and that we don't know that we have a choice. But if we slow down, if like, that gap you're talking about, if we open that gap, we have this opportunity to move away from suffering. And this can be our own suffering, or it can be the suffering of others, right? And what does the world look like if most of the time we can pause and make a choice to move away from suffering? Like, it's a really different world, which,
I would like to see that
that's,
world.
well, me too. And that is why I just feel really committed to, like, we just need to keep offering young people the opportunity to learn how to open up that gap so that they can choose to move towards or away from suffering in every moment. And, I just remain optimistic that the more people who can learn to create that space, nobody wants to suffer. And I don't think most of us, if we think about it, want to cause suffering for other people. I don't believe that most of us actually, if we have awareness, want to do that. So,
It's I think unfortunately it's become part of our political environment where causing suffering on others is viewed as winning. And that's really sad. That's not.
Yeah, I think those folks aren't paying close enough attention to what is happening to themselves.
Yeah. Well, it seems like, you know, this kind of back to this, some of this, you know, some in a way, maybe capitalist ideas that it's everything is viewed as zero sum. And that if you lose, somehow I gain. And then if I, you know, or that if you gain, then I necessarily lose. And I mean, there are, of course, some things that are zero sum. But if you get rights, that doesn't take rights away from me. Rights don't work that way.
It's funny how most things actually aren't zero sum.
Right.
Funny how we think that most everything is, but actually it's like, there really aren't that many things, like, you know, like a sporting competition, like that's zero sum. But, you know, I mean,
love and compassion are things you put out there. You don't have less of it because you put it out there.
Right? Exactly.
It actually grows.
Right.
And helping other people thrive is going to help everyone else thrive, right? It's not So, yeah. You got to pay attention. You got to be present. You got to see you got to be curious about what is true and valuable in this moment, because that is all you got. You got this moment.
On that note, Holly, it's a delight as always. You're an amazing human being. I'm so grateful for this
yeah,
time.
Absolutely. Thank you so much.
Yeah, it was a fun conversation.
Friends, your challenge this week, check out the website, mindfulnessinstituteforemergingadults.com. There's slashes and other things in there. We'll put that in. Will we, Phil?
We'll put it in the show notes.
So check that out. They've got a whole bunch of sample exercises you can go through. Yes, please.
Go to student resources.
Yes, that was the slash. I didn't say the whole slashes. Student resources / free guided meditations.
There's a bunch of resources.
There's tons of stuff on there. And we also, as Phil mentioned earlier, we recommend getting Holly's book, The Mindful 20-something. Again, as a 50-something, I always get value out of it as well. So that's a great, great resource.
All right. So I guess that's all for this episode. It's the delayed wrap up. So subscribe to Thriveology Lab on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, YouTube, or wherever you get your podcasts. Leave a comment or question on YouTube and we'll be sure to respond. Be sure to follow us on Instagram and Facebook. If you have questions or there's something you want us to talk about, please reach out to ThriveologyLab@gmail.com. Thrive on.
Thrive on, friends.